Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. So I'd like to say hello to everyone tuning in from Australia, Asia, Africa, Antarctica, Europe, and of course, North and South America. Jima and I are excited to be with you once again. So let's take a look at what's on tap for today. Another whopping NAACP report is out. It's called Defending Democracy, Confronting Modern Barriers to Voting Rights in America. We take a look at Herman Cain's final chapter. He appears in a BET exclusive. We also look at the GOP. They conduct their 5,223,489 debate and counting. So if you're a member of the GOP, do you know who you're going to vote for? Who won the debate? Also coming up in the second half of the show, we do an exclusive report on life after. We reflect on the changes in healthcare, how it affects a soldier's life after getting out of the military. We also explore the changes in the diversity and inclusion culture. We take a look at what do I do now that I'm out? A soldier's dilemma after ETS. And finally, we discuss how the chain of command in civilian life is really hard compared to the grasp of the chain of command when in the military. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Again, the number is 323-580-5712. For those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button. Or, of course, follow me on Twitter. And that's at TaylorMade101. And I will be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room opened. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old Marbell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at our current events. Okay, first up, the NAACP report. Now, I'm happy to say that the NAACP has done it again. Just recently, they released a 67-page report entitled Defending Democracy, Confronting Modern Barriers to Voting Rights in America. Now, of course, the NAACP is sending its report out to the United Nations in conjunction with a Stand for Freedom rally across from the UN's new headquarters. A New York headquarters, that is. Now, supporters are also being asked to sign an online pledge which asks the United Nations to investigate and condemn voter suppression tactics in the United States. Now, I don't know if you remember this, but we covered this a little while ago back in April, but the NAACP released a report called Misplaced Priorities. It examined America's escalating levels of prison spending and its impact on state budgets and our nation's children. Now, of course, you can get the report at NAACP.org. and you can look for misplaced priorities. But it is very obvious to me that the NAACP understands the significance of collecting the data in order to do whatever is necessary to infect change. Now, I understand this because in my world, in the world of engineering, in the world of computer science, in the world of science, the perception or your perception or how you feel about certain trends sometimes gets you nowhere. However, when you have data to back up or substantiate what you believe to be true, then most of the time it's a call for action. Now, I can say I'm starting to see the NAACP get more and more involved. And as a result, at least in my eyes, they are gaining a lot of momentum and things are starting to happen. Now, I believe that W.B. Du Bois, of course, William Edward Burghardt Du Bois, would be very proud to see that after a century, the NAACP is still fighting for the advancement of colored people. Now, of course, for many, many years, I was wondering why they didn't say the advancement for black people or the advancement for African-American people. But as I see the developments in our society with respect to happening to Latinos, what was happening to Muslims, what's happening to African-Americans and a lot of people of color, I have now come to realize the vision behind the national advancement for the of colored people. So when I now look at the NAACP's naming convention, it now resonates with me so much that I now can see why it was done in that way. But here's what I find interesting, and what I have been alluding to over the past several months. This suppression of the vote campaign by the parties involved, and it could be GOP, it could be some Blue Dogs, it could be a lot of people that's doing it behind the scenes. But they have strategically placed themselves in key positions. Governors, state legislators, super PACs, with the advent of corporations or people. However, there is some evidence to suggest that the president and organizations like the NAACP are using other vehicles within the confines or the constraints of the process to still get things done, to make things happen. So in other words, what I'm saying is if Congress won't act because the elected officials that are in office are intentionally stopping or blocking the process, well, why not go to the UN and have an international neutral party intervene? Now, I consider it a case of the battered wife syndrome. If he keeps beating you and can coming back to say he's sorry, at some point you have to get outside help. Otherwise, it could mean your demise. In a similar sense, we need to stop getting our heads bashed in, or it could mean the end of us as we know it. Now, is it a coincidence that President Obama has been traveling around working with the UN for the last 6 months? Or is this by design? You decide. And when we return, we will open up the phone lines and take your comments on this issue. And later, we will be talking about life after, the transition from a soldier to civilian life. Stay tuned. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company, tailor-made training and consulting, Current Events and Ask Jima can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jamal. and asked Jima, says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And, of course, my East Boone friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. In just a few minutes, we are going to open up the phone lines. And for you to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. But first, joining me live in the studio is the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer for TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Jima Hill Cook. Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, the pleasure is mine. So let's get right to it. Now, Jima, we've been talking about this for a very long time. What do you make of this NAACP report?
Well, I think it was something that they had to do if they were going to come up with some strategies to address the issue. I think it's an excellent report that I hope people would go out to NAACP website, which is NAACP.org website, to look at the report in its entirety, because I think we would be surprised at some of the information that they gathered during this report. So if we come on yet another election in 2012, which some say will be historic being measured because of everything that's attached to it, that to make sure that we are equipped and armed with the right information, because once we're armed with the right information, we can make the best decisions. So I think the NAACP, in its sense of urgency, felt the need to get this report out now, which gives us and those most affected by it enough time to get things in order, especially as it relates to what some of the requirements are going to be as it relates to documentation needed. It gives us enough time to either save for it, make sure we know what the rules are in order to get the information that we need. It gives us time to do that. So hopefully we will take full advantage of it and go out, and if not for ourselves, then find someone who may need some help and begin to help them through this process. Because they may not know what to do. They may not know that there's something they can do besides nothing.
You know, I definitely hear, and that definitely resonates with me. I want to read something to you. I want to reiterate something that I said in the opening monologue, and I wanted to get you to respond. And it's associated with the NAACP sending its report to the United Nations in conjunction with its Stand for Freedom rally across from the UN's New York headquarters. What do you make of delivering the report to the UN of all places?
Well, I think it speaks to the fact that we're often talking about what other countries are doing that show some sort of disenfranchisement of their citizens, and yet here we are in the great state of the United States of America And here we are, you know, doing some of the same things we're saying about other people. So I think it was a great move. It was very strategic. And what this report does for me is that it takes us out of emotion. We can get so emotional about this thing, our rights, that we sometimes don't have the data to follow up all the emotions, or when we go to present something to someone, we can't necessarily prove it because we don't have any numbers to back it up. We can just talk on theory or what we heard. This report takes the emotion out of it and looks bare bone at the facts of the situation, and that's what you need when you're trying to effect change, is you need facts. Emotions are good when you're defending your position, but at the end of the day, when you want people to make change, they need to see numbers. They need to see how it has an impact on them, and they need to know that it's not an isolated event. It's not a one state out of 50. You're looking at 25 states, over half. You're looking at half of the United States having done something that will have an impact on voter registration and voting in terms of some form of restriction come November of 2012. Well, actually, some of it starts in January. And, you know, people have different things they vote for in their states throughout the year, not just the major election. So you have some things that will go into effect at the beginning of the year. That's next month in some of these states, and we need to know that.
As an engineer, I deal with this all the time. I deal with people talking about emotion. I deal with people talking about what their perception is. And, you know, I always ask for the data. I always ask and say, okay, yeah, I see, you know, it looks as if this is happening. But when you look at the data, it kind of gives, you know, it kind of put things in a different light, and so you can make better decisions. And ultimately, it provides you with the details you needed to effect change. So my question now, though, is I want to kind of shift the conversation along the lines of the confidence in the GOP's strategy or philosophies or policies with respect to being a strategy or policy that works for the American people. Because I'm of the mindset that if I have a superior strategy, if I have a belief in tax breaks or what creates jobs, if I have a belief in, you know, deregulation is what stimulates growth in the economy, then I wouldn't have to go and enact all of these different tactics or strategies to suppress or to prohibit certain groups from voting. So my question to you, Jima, is what do you think, what does this say to the overall policies or strategies for the GOP?
That they would do something such as this in terms of changing some of the voting rights in some states?
Yeah. So basically, if I got a good strategy, I mean that what I'm saying is working. I got the GOP. I said you cut taxes. I'm saying that yeah, you deregulate, and I know that this should resonate with the majority of the American people, in such that I know if I put my candidate up with that message against your candidate says for the people, my candidate should win every time. But if I have to result to some strategies or techniques or tactics to say that, well, you know, I may be standing on shaky ground here, then it seems to me that their strategy or philosophy is not conducive to what their policy. I'm getting a lot of feedback on your end, Jima. I'm losing or something is happening.
Okay, sorry. Is that better?
Yes. And your response?
Well, I think what they saw in 2007, going up to it, I think they saw that the president's ground game was something that would go down in history because they've never seen anything before. I think that they took a look at, you know, A, they probably didn't believe he was going to get elected anyway because they had no idea he would be able to go up against, quote-unquote, the political machine of the Clintons and come out on top. So they created this strategy. They really started in the midterm elections of 2010. Actually, it started at his inauguration, And when he came in the office and decided he wanted to start talking about health care, their position to derail and create their own message started then. They were somewhat successful because a lot of people fell asleep at the wheel during those midterm elections and during that health care debate. They allowed it to become about some things that it was not. The president, I don't think, handled that well. The White House and I don't think the White House or even the Democratic Party in its totality handled that situation well. So it allowed the Tea Party to grow out of the Republican Party, and it allowed it to become something bigger than life. The media played right into it as well. So, you know, that strategy then worked. So then they said, okay, well, let's try this. So come last midterm election, they ran on balancing the budget and made everything be about the taxes and all of that. And some people was asleep at the wheel again, didn't go vote. Or I think you had more independents switch sides than you had minorities not go out and vote. But that's my own personal opinion. According to George Curry of Emerge, George Curry says that as it relates to minority vote during an off presidential election, our numbers were the same. So it wasn't our numbers that decreased. I say that it was primarily probably independent voters who switched sides from Democrat to Republican during the midterm. And so then come January of 2011, now they have a little buyer's remorse because they're seeing some of the changes that these people are wanting to put into place that's going to have a immediate direct impact on their lifestyle. And so what they did worked. I mean, and so they're like, well, let's keep pushing. Let's try this. Let's try that. And what we have to recognize is, as you say oftentimes, Patrick, is that our politics is local. And these things are happening state by state. This isn't coming out of Washington. This is coming out of the elected officials in your state, in your home district, right there in whatever your capital city is in your state. Ours is Austin and Topeka, you know, and Denver and all these in Georgia, where all these states are making these changes. They're coming right out of your state legislators. And so people have to take some ownership in what they allow to happen in their own state districts.
So what do you make of the NAACP bypassing our legislation to go straight to the UN and to bring a worldwide visibility to this issue? You know, I want to say that, in my humble opinion, is that we talk about, you know, extending freedom abroad. We talk about making sure that the Iraqis had the right to vote. We remember they had that campaign with the finger and the little ink on the finger, and they published that across the news. It seems like that they are trying to get the world to get this on the world stage because they don't have confidence in our legislation department.
Well, who could blame them? I don't disagree with that. I think it's an excellent strategy, because if you look at what has happened over the last 18 months, anything that the president has tried to do through our Congress in Washington has often been met with filibuster, has been met with voting it down, and he has been able to get even some of the most simple things done that would help everybody, not just a small pocket of people. And they haven't been very conciliatory in working with him. So I don't blame the NAACP. I think it's an excellent strategy. You go where you know you're going to get noticed. I mean, when you take a look at Occupy Wall Street to some seems so disorganized. But you tell me a group of people who didn't know one another from across the country, from sea to sea, that decided to say we're going to occupy these particular areas. I would say there was some organization there. And so what did they do? They changed the debate. They changed the topics. Now we're talking about income inequality, something that we were not talking about as a nation before that. And so the NAACP said we're going to take it to where we know we're going to get some notice. We're going to release this report on the 5th. On the 9th, we're going to be out marching towards the UN building, and we're going to hand deliver them this report. Somebody needs to take a look at this to say whether or not this is legal, whether or not some of these states have violated are in the process of violating some constitutional rights here, and how dare we be the moral authority for every other nation and allow this to happen at our, in our own nation. I applaud the end of it. I think it's a bold move, very bold,
and time for it. You know, what about, how much of this is protecting the president, too?
What do you mean?
Well, the fact that because he's going to the UN as opposed to going through, you know, our normal process or within the United States, it seems like it's protecting the president in such that he doesn't have to be associated with it, because they would be quick to tie him to everything that's going on. But because of their kind of bypassing the whole concept of what we do here in the United States and going directly to the UN, Do you think that it removes the president for any kind of responsibility or trying to tie him to this issue?
I'm going to say that I think they went to the UN with the president's approval. Not that I know that to be true, but based on what I think I know, I think that they probably had a conversation with the president prior to releasing this report. I'm going to say the president knew what was in this report, he and Attorney General Holder, and I think this is a strategy to go out, to go there first, and then when the UN brings it back to the United States, then they can't say, they, whoever the naysayers are of the report, can't say, oh, he's just doing this because, or Eric Holder is just doing this because. They will have to answer to the UN, and they're going to have an answer that's going to sway the UN from posing any sort of sanctions or whatever. So I think it's a brilliant strategy. It kind of, I agree with you, it kind of absolves the president from taking a direct hit. But I guarantee you, I think down in my gut, he knew that they were going to do this. I don't think he's shocked or they call him off guard or they trying to air the president's dirty laundry or anything like that. I really believe this was a strategy to go outside first and then force those in positions of power to really take a look at it. Because right now, they say the reason why they are making these things so restrictive is because of voter fraud, and yet we now know that the rate of voter fraud is so low, 0.00005, you know. So that can't be the truth, but that's the story. That's what got the most media attention, was it was all about voter fraud. And so now that we know that that's not true, and that was a scare tactic that they used on people, to implement some of these things. So I think the NAACP probably did this with the blessings of the president, of the White House, of the Department of Justice, knowing that to do so, it would help them in the long run.
Okay, now that's fair. I think that it is good to kind of go through the chain of command, if you will, to make sure everything is in line before you take that next leap. So I want to shift to some more concrete issues associated with the report as we move in this last part of this segment. I want to talk about the idea of having a vote or an ID card to go vote. Isn't it reasonable to think that someone should be able to have identify themselves when they go vote?
Of course, but there's more than one way for me to identify myself. The issue is not having a voter ID as much as it is having a photo ID. So that's different. So you're saying, and let me preface that by saying a current photo ID. So let's say I am someone whose state issued ID card has expired, but everything else I have, my current voter registration card is current. Everything else that I have on file in terms of where I live, utilities, all of that stuff is current, but my picture and the expiration on my state issue ID card is now expired. So because of that, that photo ID is no longer acceptable. So it's not just a voter ID, it's a photo ID that's causing the concern.
Well, isn't it reasonable to think that one would need a photo ID? I mean, why would I have an ID without having, you know, some identifying mark on that ID to make an association with that document to who owns that document. I mean, I think that's a reasonable request to have an ID to be able to demonstrate you are who you say you are. Let me elaborate. Let me ask the question before that. So let's say, well, let me ask you this question. Do you remember or have you been involved in or do you know someone that has faked an ID when they were younger and perhaps used that fake identification to buy beverages or to get into clubs or to do things along those lines?
Yes.
Okay, so we know that there are instances out there where people fabricate ID cards, right? We know that people, especially in this age of the digital age where people's identities are being stolen, you know, probably every second. So isn't it reasonable to suggest that one should have a voter or some type of identification card that's current that has a photo on it to verify that this person is, in fact, A, is registered to vote, and B, is who they say they are? One vote, you know, one person, one vote.
I would support that if the data showed that was a necessity. But the data doesn't show that. The data does not show that we have a preponderance of voter fraud with people showing up to vote with an ID that is not theirs. That's not what the data shows. So because the data doesn't show that, then there's no need to change some of the things that they're changing. Okay, so let's say the data doesn't show that. Why change the length of time for early voting? Why change the days that you can early vote on? Why not allow voter registration and voting to happen on the same day? Why do with all of those things if you're saying the issue is not having a valid photo ID? See,
I agree.
That they've lumped all of that in there, it tells you, or it should tell you, that this is not just about addressing voter fraud, because the data does not support that there is widespread voter fraud. That is a lie.
I'm in full agreement with you that the fact that the data doesn't support the rationale that they're using to for this movement. But I still would argue that it is a valid request for someone to show their identification during voters during it's time to vote. And I would also argue that the shortness of time allows us to save dollars when it comes to the voters process. If we can get the window closed, you know, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, and such that we can now get everybody in and get everybody out, as opposed to stringing this thing along, because the longer you string it along, the more it's going to cost, the more people is going to be involved, the more resources it's going to consume. So I can understand logically why, you know, you can shorten the windows. I can understand, you know, it's reasonable to request a person bring their ID, but I don't agree with the rationale that they're using to do that.
Well, I'm going to respectfully disagree with your logic, because I don't even find that to be logical. What you just said, of shortening the window and saving money, because what's going to happen is, because you are shortening that time that people do have, you're going to have more people in line, which means I believe it was in 2004 or 2006 in the state of Ohio, you had people standing in line 10 hours to vote, 10 hours, because of the length of time and the day that people had to vote. So you're not saving any money that way. That's a false equivalency, number one. The second thing is that when you say that you have to have a photo ID, prior to this, all I needed to go and vote with was my voter registration card. I didn't need my photo ID. If my voter registration card was current, that's all I needed, period. Now, so it didn't matter if my ID was expired or not. I needed to have my voter registration card that showed my address, that had my signature, and which means I was on the roll. That's all I had to take with me. Now I have to take two things with me: my voter registration card, and my photo ID, which isn't a problem for me because I drive, and so my license has to be up to date. But you look at the person that doesn't drive. You look at the college student. You look at the person who's transient, who's homeless. You know, you're asking them to maintain pieces of paper that in my opinion, is a way to silence the vote. It's not going to get more people to vote. And I think at the end of the day, that's what their intent was. So I disagree with you in terms of it's a point to save money, or they can, you know, cut on some costs or whatever. That, that's somewhat of a legitimate point, I guess. But at the end of the day, when you have people standing in line for 10 hours to vote, so that means you're going to have that many more people there that's going to have to work overtime to help them, and that many more people there that's going to have to count those votes as they come in. If you have a longer period, you have more time to get it right. When you shorten that window, you also increase the opportunity for some inaccuracies to occur from those people that are responsible for tallying up those votes.
You know, I hear you and understand, and I would just love to get, you know, people to weigh in on this. And so to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. So, you know, I want to kind of just to clarify one thing with respect to the number of people in line, because I believe that there's a lot of waste in our political process. I believe there's a lot of waste in the way we do our voters registration, where we do voting, I mean, you know, just anything along those lines. You know, I'm going to suggest that although you may have more people in line, you're not going to get more people voting or less people voting because of that. I think that people that are concerned, that are people that are engaged, and I think people that are informed about the process will make the corrections, will ID vote early because they don't want to stand in line, because you know, it's nonsense to stand out there all day when you could get your vote in early. I mean, all of these things will streamline the process. And if you streamline the process as far as time is concerned, yeah, ultimately it will save you money over time. And we're already in a real debt crisis situation. We spend too much money. We waste a lot. And so I would suggest that if you do shorten that window, people will be more concentrated on their efforts to get their vote in, to get it counted, and to move on.
But once again, I would respectfully disagree. I don't think you'll have more people. You'll probably have the same amount of people. They just won't have as much time to do it. Whereas prior to, you had a state that went from 35 days of early voting now down to 21 days of early voting. So you've shortened that time, you know, by 2 weeks of when people have availability to do so. But let me just say something else. And based on what the report says from the NAACP, that 11% of the citizens nationwide, that is 22.9 million people, do not have government-issue IDs. 22.9 people do not have government-issued photo IDs. That's a lot of people. That is a lot of people. And
I have
so
to agree with
for
you.
Us to, excuse me?
I say I agree with you.
And so when you look at and you break that down, that 25% of African Americans, that's over 6 million people that are the voting age, 16% of Latino voting age, nearly 3 million, do not possess a valid government issued photo ID. So those are significant numbers. Those are significant numbers that has been and will be affected by some of these changes that are pending, and some have been blocked by some Supreme Court, but some will take an effect come January.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. At any rate, we need to pay attention. If we sleep on this one, it could change the dynamics for a generation to come. It's time for us to take another break, and on the other side of the break, we will take a look at Herman Cain's final chapter. Now, be sure to go out to our blog at tailormadetalkradio.blogspot.com. That's TAILORMADE, D as in Delta, E as in Echo, Talk Radio, all one word, tailormadetalkradio.blogspot.com. This is where you will find a unique perspective and stimulating commentary on the current events. And, of course, I invite you to check that out. So stay tuned. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook.
I'm tired of charging.
need a new website, haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full-service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I wanted to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my East Boone friend.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. The phone lines are open. And to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Now, just a few minutes, we're going to shift the conversation here and to Herman Cain. Now, just this past week, he was on BET. Now, mind you, this has been a long time coming for him. He's been, riding his high horse for a while. And just last week, he kind of suspended his campaign, if you will. So it was kind of interesting to see this. Now, so I see this. Now, I don't know if you're going to agree with this, the listening audience out there, but I see this as using African-Americans to get heard and now coming back to beg for forgiveness. Now, after all, people can now say that the Tea Party is not racist anymore because look at their number one guy is a black man. Now, he said a lot of, my opinion, crazy things when he was out on the campaign trail, kind of dissing black folks. And now for him to come and show up on BET, I just thought it was kind of, using black people. So, I mean, that's just my opinion. And so I like what this article that thyblackman.com had. And here's what it had to say. He said that Christmas has come early. Herman Cain is no longer pretending to run for president. It is for that reason that he was selected BET to air his final interview. Now, a curious decision considering that throughout his campaign, Herman Cain had deliberately avoided any association with African Americans or the political issues traditionally of concern to the black community. But a couple of nights ago, Black Entertainment Television, BET, aired a half-hour documentary on Herman Cain's now-defunct candidacy for the GOP presidential nomination. The segment entitled The Curious Case of Citizen Cain was an homage of sorts to the classic Orson Welles film Citizen Kane, which ironically tells the story of a wealthy businessman turned political hopeful who sees his chances of winning office derailed by a sex scandal. Now, the film, often considered one of the greatest of all time, was originally released in the 1940s, the decade of Herman Cain's birth. The parallels between the Cain plot line and the Herman Cain's campaign trajectory are uncanny, though neither are based in reality. Now, this was a fact not lost on the producers at BET, who, to my surprise, provided a unique opportunity for Herman Cain to speak directly to an African-American audience, many of whom never quite embraced his Tea Party rhetoric and anti-Obama message, but still wanted insight into what made this particular black man tick. So, Jima, I want to know, what do you make? First of all, let me ask this question. You know, am I being too cynical when I use the term he's using African-Americans?
Yes, I think so.
Why is that?
Well, here's the thing. And looking at the interview on BET, first of all, it was recorded prior to the whole Ginger White issue. So it was recorded on November 18th, which was still around the scandal, but the improprieties as it related to the sexual harassment, but before the Jennifer White story came out. And so listening to their reporting about some of the things Mr. Cain had to say, it was quite interesting. And even listening to some of the supporters of Herman Cain, who were African-American, they felt like he was speaking a new language in terms of economics and in terms of self-empowerment and taking care of yourself and not relying on somebody else to take care of you. They felt like, you know, what he was saying, that's what resonated with those young supporters that I saw. They were like mid-20s, you know, maybe, you know, late 30s or whatever. But that part of his message is what resonated with them. And even one young lady went so far as to say that it really wasn't about black or white or Democratic or Republican. She said for her it was all about the green and how she can keep more of it in her pocket. So
okay,
I definitely understand that.
Makes a lot of sense. So what do you make of the interview, though?
Well, here's the thing. You know, I took some notes because I wanted to make sure that I didn't miss anything. And a couple of things he said make sense in terms of economic growth is key to everything that we have going on in this country. I agree with that. I don't think you'll find anybody who understands any, you know, about where we are right now, the economics is truly important. However, comma, having said that, I do think he, in his knack to oversimplify, he also kind of downplayed some of the stereotypes that was prevalent in the Tea Party before, you know, he became, quote unquote, the spokesperson. But let's step back a minute and realize that Herman Cain was a radio show host on a conservative station in Atlanta. So his thoughts were not new because we just heard them. That's how he talks all the time. And that's why a large majority of his base, they knew him, white people, because that's who listened to him on his show. So that's not new language that he was talking. It was just new to the majority of us because no one was listening to his show. So you look at the fact that he goes to Antioch Baptist Church North there in Atlanta. And in that same church is a young lady who's a state representative for the state of Georgia, a black person. And she says, you know, I've never listened to his radio show because there's nothing he's going to say to me that's going to make any sense. She said, so all we can do is teach him the Bible. She said, I don't know where he got all that other stuff from. So,
Right.
So, you know, and then he went back to the church in his quote-unquote community. You know, they say he was born and raised in the projects down there. And so he has some sort of connection, quote-unquote, to the black experience. I think what I found to be most, for me, most, alarming is that he made the statement that he felt, and this was out of his book, well, he still felt like on that day
in November 18, 2011, that he was confident he could take 30% of the black vote from the president. I just think that's extremely funny. But anyway, I find that he really felt strongly about that he could take away 30% of the black vote. But something he said in one of his books, the book entitled They Think You're Stupid, he said in that book that he felt that he said that Reverend Jesse Jackson, Reverend Joseph Lowry, Julian Bond, and others, he called them scam artists. And he said that they have misled too many black people because white racism is not the cause of the problems in black America.
Okay. So what planet is he living on?
Well,
I'm going to say that in the context of our beginnings, right? I often talk about starting from zero. I often talk about the fact that, you know, when you look at the legacy of African Americans, a large majority started out in the negative. And, you know, in the laws that were in place and all of the atrocities that were levied against us, caused us to be in the negative. We didn't do that on our own. And then you look at the psychology that was placed, in our psyche over generations, and it's still causing effect. Look at the fight that was happening on TV the other day between Cincinnati and Xavier. I mean, there's many instances of the psychology of African Americans have been destroyed because of all of those atrocities that happened to us a long time ago. So we can't dismiss that. Now, I can agree that, you know, nowadays you have more opportunities, more chances, you know, more things available for you to do that. And we have to come out and be able to rise to the occasion. But I think it's ludicrous to say that did not have an effect on us.
I agree. And that's why he would not have garnered 30% of anybody's vote making those sorts of statements and innuendos because you can't really single out those particular people that some view as iconic in the black community, some view as really having fought and the struggle for real and call them out as scam artists. I mean, I just find that to be appalling on so many levels. So when he made that statement, I was like, you know what? See, this is why I can't take you serious. Because go ahead and say that there comes a time when we can't blame everything
on somebody else. Go ahead and make that
statement, because I agree with you.
Right.
But we can't act like those things did not happen, and we cannot act like those things did not have
an effect
on us. Because when you look at the fact that we can make decisions now and that we have to and we take advantage of the now opportunities that we have that we did not have before. See, when you talk about separate but equal and Brown versus the Board of Education, there's a reason that now we can say we now have access.
Right.
Because
before we
didn't. And there's a reason we can now say we need to take advantage of the access. Don't just say I can go to the library and never go.
Right.
Because then that's even a bigger slap in the face of those who fought and died than the slap that Herman Cain gives it by acting like it didn't happen.
So that's why it's hard for him to resonate with a large majority of the population, because he used that rhetoric. We can all appreciate his story. We could all congratulate on him on his success, and we don't feel any negativity to him for that. But for him to come out and just say, what you did didn't matter, and yeah, that was crazy, and you should be able to do this on your own, that's crazy for him to say that. And so, although, you know, I'm going to go on record and say that, you know, I think he ran a magnificent mock campaign. You know, I think he ran a magnificent book tour. You know, but for him to suggest that, you know, that we should go out and pull ourselves by our own bootstraps when we didn't have any boots at all for a long period of time, I think it's crazy.
Right. And one more thing before I know we're going to take a break. There was something else that came out to me. The interviewer asked him, you know, what did he say to those people that questioned him in terms of not really being a part of the civil rights movement, or, you know, even really, you know, adhering to some of the beliefs or values or whatnot. And he said he was a leader in a different kind of way, and that he broke stereotypes by some of the jobs that he went and got, such as he was the first black whatever for Pillsbury. And so he wanted to show we could work in different types of settings and still provide an example to them by working in those sorts of environments that were completely different than what we've ever worked in before. So that's why he wasn't really involved in the quote-unquote movement, because he was out breaking down those sorts of doors. Now, those are his words, not mine. And one more thing that I thought was quite interesting coming out of it was one of the young people that they did interview. One of the things that I took away from what he said his legacy was going to be, he said his legacy was show that he redefined the debate and that he redefined the focus from more of the same to bold solutions going forward. I'm not real sure what those bold solutions are. 999, that became 909. I'm not sure what those bold solutions are. But I think what I found to be most interesting is that there's that younger group of black voters, black Americans, African Americans, that are not that impressed, and I say that in air quotes, that are not that impressed with the struggles of the civil rights movement. They don't seem to have an allegiance to that. So people like Herman Cain resonate with them because they've never not had anything. But when you flip that over, when you look at young white Americans, they've never not had, you know, relationships with people of other races. So that's why it doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal to them either. And so that's why it's important, not that we talk about our history to shame, but we talk about our history to keep people informed that, you know, in a wink of an eye, this can all be gone. Just take a look at what's happening with the voting rights issue.
Absolutely right. Yep.
So, you know, it goes hand in hand, and what we take for granted, these very same students or very same people could be affected by something if they are not, you know, in order with what the new law says. So it's not that we talk about our past to shame someone else or to bring another group down, but we have to be mindful and vigilant about how we got here, because the same energy it took for us to receive those rights is the same energy it takes to maintain them. And that is the same thing going forward with this upcoming election. The same energy that it took to get President Obama not just elected but noticed is the same energy it's going to take for us to be out there reminding people. And in some cases, it's not even reminding. Some cases, it is truly informing people of what he has accomplished in this time that he's been in office, because some in the media will continue to overshadow his successes with the economy and the fact that it has not turned around at the rate in which everyone thought it would. But no one really knew the mess we were in either. And so as though it didn't take 3 years to get in this mess, it's not going to take 3 years to get out. And I think we owe it to the president enough time to fix what was wrong when he walked into office back in that cold day, January of 2009. And I think we've, you know, that energy that pushed us and motivated us to get out and get people registered, we have to have that same motivation to make sure people have the right IDs, the right pieces of paper, all of those things, to spread the word of what he has accomplished, what he has been able to accomplish outside of Congress. And take a look at those things in that way. We have to have that same sort of energy.
Yeah, I have to agree. You know, in my estimation, with respect to Herman Cain, though, I say again, I think he took the mock campaign to the next level. And he is definitely a household name coupled with sex, politics, and scandal. The only thing I think left for Herman Cain to do is now come out with the sex tape.
I agree. I'm sure Ginger is probably holding that, you know, until, you know, the bitter end. But if she's, you know, in as financial straits, dire straits as they say, I'm pretty sure National Enquirer would be paying for that story.
I know that's right. We're going to take a moment to pay some bills. When we return, Life After, a conversation with current and military veterans. Now, be sure to check out our blog at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. That's TAILORMADE, D as in Delta, E as in Echo, Talk Radio, all one word. This is where you will find a unique perspective and stimulating commentary on the current events. And I encourage you to go out and Google me. That's Current Events with Patrick Cook. So stay tuned. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my East Point.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TAILORMADE101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I want to remind everyone that the phone lines are open. So to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And just a couple of seconds from now, just a minute or two from now, we're going to be talking to one current military soldier and two military veterans, and to include myself, I'm also going to join the conversation. And we're going to be talking about several things. In particular, I want to kind of talk about healthcare, diversity, inclusion, time and leadership. Those are the contexts in which discussion will take place. And we'll hear from our military veterans, and one is about to retire, to talk a little bit about the dynamics around those things and to kind of have you join the conversation. Again, to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. And we're going to be talking with Orlando James and Chief Hurst. Now, Chief Hurst, of course, was on with us a couple of weeks ago, and he's the soldier that was actually in the process of retiring and transition. So he talked about this program, I believe the name was TAPS, and he's going to give us a report. He actually went through the TAPS program. He actually went through all of the different the stages in the processes and in preparation. And he's going to talk about his experience along those lines. Now, recall, Chief Hurst was born and raised in Oklahoma City. He graduated from Southeast High School and completed an associate degree in general studies from Columbia College. But he has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from the University of Oklahoma. And in fact, I attended that graduation and was a proud friend there. He began his 23-year naval career at Recruit Training Command in Great Lakes, Illinois in 1988. And also James Lewis, he's an educator, motivator, and an advisor. He's a native of Hampton, Virginia. James Lewis completed his bachelor's degree, Bachelor of Science in Organizational and Human Resource Management from Colorado Christian University. And he and his family relocated to Colorado Springs in 2002. James served 15 years in the United States Army as an ammunition specialist and medic. Now, Mr. Lewis now is a resident of Cedar Hill, Texas. He is currently pursuing an MBA from, Latunu University in Human Resource Management. Now, Mr. Lewis is currently an advocate for education and domestic violence. He also served on various boards and organizations. He is dedicated to being a lifelong learner and believes that everyone has an opportunity to excel and succeed in life. And then finally, Orlando will be joining us here soon. He's attended Wyandotte High School, graduated with honors. He attended Bethany College in Kansas. And he was in the military from 87 to 89. And he was affiliated with the military until 2005 because of his spouse. Now, he worked with youth in one capacity or another for the last 21 years. Now, currently, he's self-employed but seeking other opportunities. And he want to make sure that everybody get an opportunity to speak with him out there. So I would like to welcome in these gentlemen to the show. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Mr. Patrick.
All right. Wonderful to have you with us here today. So first up, I want to talk about something that was near and dear to my heart. Now, I'm going to say I had no idea about this until Jima and I was having a conversation about healthcare. So I'm going to kind of give you the backstory, and then I want you guys to kind of weigh in with your experience. And James, we'll start with you when I pose the question. So it was kind of along the lines that I had been in the military for a number of years, and of course I didn't have to worry about healthcare because when you get sick, you just go to health, what they call sick call. And sick call, for those that are unaware of, is a time that you would get up in the morning and you would go to your local area where they would have a medic or have a little, like a first aid station. And they could provide you with, you know, the most basic components of, you know, of getting you taken care of, and which was fine. And so after being, if you need some more, attentive care, they would in turn send you to the hospital for more extended care. And so that was my experience for 12 years, 11 months, and 15 days while in the military. So when I get out of the military, I actually was afforded the opportunity to work for a corporation, and in turn didn't really see any disruption in my health care. So I was kind of unaware of this thing called pre-existing conditions. And so we had a conversation around, you know, changing insurance and doing this or using whatever. And then she said to me, well, it's not that simple. I said, well, all you have to do is just go to the doctor, to the hospital. She said, it's not that simple. You have to be concerned with pre-existing conditions. I'm like, what is that? And so I want to kind of, James, I want you kind of weigh in on this, is, what was the significant change in your health care when you got out of the military compared to when you were in?
To be honest, Brother Cook, when I first got out, there was no health care. During the transition time from getting out of the military and going back to civilian life, you have that just in the period where, you're not employed, you're looking for employment, so you don't have any health care. You are authorized, you're entitled to go to the VA to seek medical attention, but if you're not rated when you go, you're responsible for all the medication and the service you receive as far as them billing.
Yeah, so, you know, I went, you know, like you, I didn't, you know, I was in college right out of the military. You know, I was using my Army College Fund GI Bill, and so when I first went, you know, I went to the VA hospital because they told me that you could go there and get healthcare, but that's not free right out of the military.
No.
And so I think the misconception for a lot of people is that, oh, you were in the military, you're okay, you get out, you just go to the VA hospital and they take care of all your medical service. That is not the case. At least I can say that has not been my experience. And so I want Chief Hurst to weigh in on this. What did you get out of the conversation about your health care benefits specifically for you and your family?
Well, what I learned out, the first thing is that you're right, there's no care once you get out. You're covered for basically 120 days after you separate. But once you, after that 120 days, you don't have any health care. So, but they do have where you can transition your military health care into civilian health care. But it's a price for that. And it gets pretty expensive, from what I understand. Yeah. So they didn't go into figures, but I'm told it's pretty expensive.
Yeah, and so, you know, when you kind of have two options, as you talked about. You have the option, of course, to go out and, you know, use the VA, which James and I talked about, and you have this option to go out and get. But I can tell you, and Jim is on the line here. Jim, do you remember when your health care costs increased? I remember you saying something about your haircut went from $1 amount to another dollar amount within, you know, a matter of a year. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. I remember working in two state systems, primarily in the state of Missouri and state of Colorado. And when I worked with the state of Missouri, of course, single, no kids, initially it was nothing. I didn't have any out-of-pocket costs. And then by the time I left, after 6 years or so of working there, it had gone up to like maybe $2 or $3. Well, when I went to Colorado, I'm still single, not married, no children. My insurance from the state of Colorado was like $47 and $50 a month. And I know the sum, that's not a whole lot of money. But when you go from paying nothing to having to pay that, I felt, well, what's different? You know, and then as the time left over the 7 years I was there, it kept going up. Every year our insurance with payments would go up, and to a point where I knew my staff was having to make decisions about whether they could even afford insurance for a family of four, especially my low-end salary staff, my food service workers, my janitorial staff. It got to a point they couldn't even afford it because it was so high. So I definitely, know. And then when I left work and that period of time that I was not covered was probably the scariest time of my life, because I just knew I would get some sort of major illness and I wouldn't have any insurance coverage. So it's a chance you take when you want to go out and be on your own, though.
Yeah, and so the bottom line here is that there is a significant change for military soldiers getting out of the military for health care. And so and that's why I'm not real sure why the conversation is going the way that it is around taking care of, just people in general when it comes to healthcare. So, James, what was the worst case scenario for you? Or what was your experience in dealing with this, and how did you deal with it?
During those times, when I first got out and I still had a wife and two kids, it was a very stressful time, because you go from a situation where the military is taking care of all your needs, and, you got little kids and they'll take care of them being sick as well, then you're out here on your own. The very first time I had to encounter the healthcare system without any insurance was a total monster. They treat you like you are a legal alien or something. I was like, I just finished serving my country and I'm just going through a transition. I don't have any insurance. And they treat you some kind of bad. But one of my kids had caught pneumonia. You're waiting in there. You're waiting for 12 hours, 16 hours. And just because you don't have insurance, you're on the back burner.
Yeah, and they have no sympathy at all. I mean, this is it's almost like a mass, assembly line to get people in and get people out. And then the way when you go out and fill out that paperwork, do you have insurance? And you can't answer the right questions, or you don't have the right paperwork, you can ultimately almost die right there. And it's kind of weird, because you just spent the last decade, taking care of protecting everything that they allow them to do and be as they are, and then they treat you like that. So what did you ultimately have to do, James?
Well, we had to go in, and they gave us a medical waiver for a person who doesn't have insurance, and they paid more than half of the bill off for me, and I was that
wow.
was a blessing within itself.
Yeah, that is a blessing. Yeah,
yes, sir. And you know, during those times, you know, it's a very humbling experience because you know you come from a situation where you feel like you're in control of your destiny. You know, you're taking care of the country, and then you go in a situation where they belittle you and they make you feel like you're not even worth the ground or the air you're breathing. You know, that's a very hard transition.
Yeah,
for many of us veterans, you know, it's a hard transition going from military to civilian because we're not used to the way they do their thing.
Right.
We are precise and timely people, and people in civilian world, they do their thing whenever they feel like it. You know, I like to be on time for church. I like to be on time for work, you know.
Mm-hmm,
and other people just like, oh, come in late, do what they want, you know, but I'm just on that, I'm still on that military schedule. I want to be on time.
Right. So Chief Hurst, what do you project happening? What's your preparation? What's your mindset like with respect to this healthcare issue when you make your transition from now in a few months?
Well, actually, Patrick, you know, this is really it's something you really didn't think about. When I went into the TAP class, my main concern was making sure I can fill out a resume correctly and whatnot, and wasn't really worried about the insurance part of it. But hearing this conversation, it's very important that we think about this. And, I mean, I'm retiring, so I do still have some medical benefits for me and my family, which is definitely a blessing. I'm not out there with nothing.
Right.
It is something that we do have to think about, people that just transitioning out, just separating out and not having a retirement, because after 120 days, they don't have anything. I'm fortunate enough that I will still be covered in some type of way.
And what's interesting about the 120 days is because, remember, the military, in most cases, not all, they take you in your prime of your life, right? They take you when you're healthy, when you're young, and they use that body to their advantage for that extended period of time. So
when
you get out of the military, now, I mean, they are very good about capturing your records. They're very good about paying you, subsidizing you in some way to capture, you know, all those things that they happen to you. But it's a small fraction of what it was when you were in the military. But my point is that they've used your body in its best condition for several years, and now when you get out, your body is not in that tip-top shape. You know, you're a lot older. You know, your lifestyle would change. You're a lot slower, and you know, things of that nature. So the issues with healthcare will arise more rapidly than it was when you were in 10 years, 15, 20 years ago. So it is incumbent upon us to really take a comprehensive look at the healthcare associated with not just us, but also our family members. So I encourage everyone to at least take a look at that. So James, what kind of recommendation or advice that you would give people that are in a situation where they are making that transition and need to consider healthcare?
I definitely do your research on the various companies that are out there. You don't have to stay with the particular companies that they offer you, because a lot of companies do offer a lower rate. You have to go out there and find them and do the research on your own. When I got out and did my transition, I had no one to help guide me or coach me in the right direction. So I was out here blind, trying to find my way. Luckily, you know, I ran into some good people later on who started to, you know, mold and shape me and guide me and, you know, leading me in the right direction to find out about the right kind of health insurance and different things like that.
Right. That's good. Good. Awesome. So what about you, Chief Hurst? What do you think? How do we get people ready that still in and still have time enough to, you know, to make sure they get the right things, make the right adjustments?
Well, first of all, while they're in, they have to make sure they get every little scratch on their body documented and get it considered as a service connected injury or whatever, because like you said, it's a small fracture, but it's better than nothing.
Right,
so when they get out, they can get that rated, and that's about the best they can do.
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to shift now to another thing that I experienced when I exited the service after over a decade and being in combat. It was that diversity and inclusion. And it was my experience dealing with the people in the military was kind of like we were all kind of one big happy family. You know, I can remember, you know, going to combat. I can remember digging foxholes. I can remember this guy was, his name was Currence. We used to, you know, laugh and joke. He had a Pinto back in the day, and we used to, you know, get on his Pinto and do all those things. But when I got out of the military, I can remember that, you know, I was in the engineering field. So the relationships that I had with those people and that were not in the military were just a lot different. So James, what has been your experience when you got out of the military? If you juxtapose the relationships with respect to diversity that you were in versus the ones that when you were out?
Definitely, it was a major transition. And a couple of me and a couple of my ex veteran buddies, we were talking about this just the other day. It's the fact that the people who the friends you make that, when you're while you're in the military, those are the gentlemen or the young ladies that you sleep in the woods with, you pull guard duty at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning for your 2 hours. They're the ones you go out on stand to with. They are the ones who, when you're in the movement, you might miss meals for 3 or 4 days. And
mm-hmm.
with that, you build a bond that's unbreakable. You know, it's one of those things where nobody understands a bond until you suffer together. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
and
right.
So, when I got out and I started, you know, working in the civilian world, you know, I started making associates. And then, you know, the loyalty and the trust just wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because they had invested. They had nothing to gain from our friendship, really, but just to say we're friends.
Right.
You know. But I do have some good friends in my corner right now that, you know, that look out for me and take care of me and coach me and guide me, especially when I was out there being a little knucklehead still, you know. And they had my back, you know, and I really appreciate them for that. But, you know, just the fact that, you know, people have no ties, no bonds together anymore from, you know, from military to civilian. And I think that's where the breakdown for me is. You know, I can't speak for everyone else, but just having those relationships where we was out there together suffering in the cold and in the rain, and we just established a friendship and a bond that's unbreakable.
Right, right. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. We're talking with some military veterans about their transition in out of the military. And so to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. You can press 1 to talk and 2 to listen. So I want to continue the conversation about the time, right? And so As we kind of closed, you know, coming up on the last half of the show, I want to tell you my experience, and I want to kind of get you to weigh in about your experience as far as time. So, of course, for 12 years, 11 months, and 15 days, every second of every minute of every hour was captured. I mean, was kind of earmarked for something in the military. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time in Germany. I was there when the wall came down. You know, I was on the I was a part of the Battle of 73 Easting with 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. I was a part of, you know, the Desert Shield, Desert Storm conflict. And so, you know, I can pretty much account for every second of every day for 12 years. But when I got out of the military and the first day that I ETS, you know, I was literally lost. I mean, I looked around and it was like, what do I do? And then, so it was a culture shock for me, and it was an adjustment period that I had to make with my time. And so, James, I want you to kind of weigh in on this and kind of tell me your perspective on this issue. James, you're talking, you're on mute.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, sir. I'm sorry about that. Yes, I mean, you know, it was the same way for me. You know, everything was accounted for, and it was just one of the processes. Like, we was counting down the days together, you know. Everybody did a two-year or three-year tour, and we just watched the time go by together.
Wow. So I think we have on the line with us Orlando. And so I want to make sure that Orlando gets an opportunity to weigh in. Orlando, you with us?
Yes, I am.
Awesome. Welcome to the show. And so I want to remind...
You.
I want to remind everybody, Orlando graduated with honors. He attended Bethany College in Kansas City. He was in the military from 1987 to 89, and he was affiliated with the military until 2005. And so, Orlando, we've really been talking about the different aspects of, you know, our experience once we make the transition. A lot of times people talk about the transition out of the military being with how do you get a job when you get out. You know, they talk about, you know, where you live. You know, they talk about those tangible things that we all know and we all hear about. But what we're discussing today is some of those intangible things. And the first thing we talked about was healthcare. You know, how did you make the transition when you had healthcare fully covered when you were in the military, but when you got out, you didn't have that same coverage? So, Orlando, I want you to talk about your experience a little bit along those lines.
That's funny that you asked that because I basically was covered with healthcare when I got out of the military because I got married in 1990, mm-hmm. and I was married till 2005. So I was covered with healthcare all those years through my wife also because she was military and she retired military. And we both took care of the boys and worked and did our thing. But when I got out and I got divorced, I was working for the state. Once I lost my job working for the state, I found myself without health care. And once that occurred, I began to have health issues for the first time in my life. You know, I'd never had any health issues, and I began to have stomach problems and things of that nature. And I was racking up some incredible bills, you know, going to the emergency rooms, you know. And they still wasn't coming up with answers. They were giving me a little medicine, a couple of IVs, and send me on my way.
Right.
And then I was basically just in the grocery store and overheard a conversation from a veteran talking about his benefits. Mm. And so I inquired and asked a couple of questions, and the next thing you know, he led me in the right direction, told me to go down to my local VA hospital and to take my DD-214 and request a copy of my military records and that they would see me. And so once I did that, they began to run these extensive tests, and it was incredible because I'd always heard all these horrible things about military hospitals, and but I had never encountered them, but I'd heard about them. But here I was in Kansas City, Kansas, and at the VA hospital, and I got the best health care that I'd ever had in my life. You know, they found out what I had, which was H. pylori. It was a stomach disease that I had, mm-hmm. and they did further tests and found out that my PSA levels were above normal, and so they tested me for prostate cancer and come to find out I had prostate cancer.
Wow.
You know, but yeah, so well, like I said, I didn't have health care insurance, you know, so how could I pay for that? And the military took me in, paid for everything, you know. They paid for all the bills. I think I ended up paying like $300-some out of my pocket.
Wow.
You know, but if it had not been for that time that I put in the military, you know, in a dishonorable discharge, that wouldn't have been available to me, you know. And there's so many of us out here that don't know that we have these things available, you know. And so every time, every chance I get, I let people know, if you've been in the military, brother, there's some benefits out there for you. There's no need in walking around sick or broken down.
Right. And so, and that's what we were talking about earlier, the fact that it's funny how these things are available and a lot of people don't know. I mean, we didn't know and we were in too. And I was, an NCO when I got out and I still didn't know these things were available to me. And so I want Chief Hurst to weigh in a little bit more about your TAPS process because you're now in the transition process. You're at the stage and when they're giving you the information on before you transition. So, Chief, weigh in about what they're giving you to denote what you what benefits are available for you when you get out.
Well, yeah, it was actually a real good class that we have, and they talked about a variety of benefits. We talked about, first of all, the first day we talked about stress management because there's a lot of stresses that's going to come up on you knowing that you're about to separate and, you know, not having a job, insurance, and all type of things that could bring up stress. So we talked about ways of how to handle stress. Then we talked about, of course, the resumes and how to do a job interview as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the last day we talked about some of the VA benefits, which could be a variety of things from school, education, teachers, truths to teachers. But you know what? Healthcare, it was just a small amount about healthcare. And I'm sitting here thinking now that they really need to put more on the healthcare side of that because you don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, they tell us all, you know, you can go to the VA, but that's just it, you know. They don't really get into details. So I think that's more information that veterans need to know, that especially ones that's been out for years, they don't know.
Right.
That they can do that.
So, Lena, talk a little bit about the cost of healthcare. When you were in, obviously it was free. And obviously, you know, you went to sick call like we all did early in the morning, you know, you get up. But when you get out, and then there's no cost associated with going to the healthcare in the middle, getting sick in the military. But when you get out, there are some costs. So is it free or not?
No, actually, there are no costs. Like for me, when I went in, they made you fill out an affidavit and some applications and saying what your financial status was. And once I told them what my financial status was, they took me in. I got great care. I will say that the aftercare program wasn't as great because I didn't have the money to buy the medications that I needed after my surgery. You know, I had prostate, you know, which is it's deep, especially for a 46-year-old man. You know, I was in there with most of the guys were in their 60s and 70s that had prostate surgery, and here I was, 43, having the surgery, and it leaves you empty and desolate and looking for answers. And those answers they didn't have when I had the surgery, but the surgery was paid for, and I'm cancer-free, praise be to God.
Oh, awesome. That's a blessing right there.
They sent me one bill for about $330, and that was my cost for the surgery, which was well over $100,000.
Wow.
You know, so it's very beneficial. There's a book out called Federal Benefits for Veterans and Dependents and Survivors, and you can get it at your local VA hospitals. And this book is so informational, you know, for veterans from the Vietnam era, the Korean War era. You know, it's so deep, you know, what they'll do for you and your dependents, Asian people with Asian Orange and all these different things, that, you know, the people that have been on the streets for 20 or 30 years and didn't know that they had these benefits, you know. And here I was, didn't know I had the benefits, and I had applied for them in 05, but I just let it go. But I kept going to see the doctor. And then someone told me, go see your VA counselor. So I went to see the VA counselor, and they did all the paperwork for my benefits, and I got paid back pay for 6 years, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So I want to go ahead and continue the conversation and talk about another issue, and we were talking about time. And when you joined, Orlando, and I wanted to make sure that everybody got your story, because I think it's a powerful one and a significant one. But I want to continue the conversation a little bit more about your time. So, James, kind of give us a little more backstory about how you felt when you got out, and you know, going from you know them having you know to do. You every second of every day until now, you having your own time to do kind of what you want.
Well, I still think that I live my life in a military type fashion. I try to be very punctual, and I still, you know, live by those codes. I just have one comment. As far as me, you know, I've been out for 15 years. I just went back last December to get my disability rating. I haven't been approved yet. As a matter of fact, they turned me down for everything I applied for. Every medication that they have given me, they have sent me a bill with that. Now, it's not as much as I would pay over the counter or if I was going into like a regular pharmacy. I grant you that. But still, I still have inquired bills from the VA because I haven't received a rating. So, you know, when we talk about that all the medication that you receive from them is free, for me that's not the case. And for many vets, it's not the case, especially if you don't have a rating. If you don't have a rating, then you're just a veteran, but you have to pay for different things. Those people who have 100% disability rating, all their stuff is free, of course, no doubt. But for me, you know, right now I'm in the process of trying to get my rating, and every time I go to the doctor and receive some medication because they said I had hypertension, PTSD, depression, different things that like that because of past combat, you know, stress syndrome. I'm inquiring bills right now as we speak.
Oh, wow. So explain to the listeners out there what you mean by rating. A lot of people are not familiar with that language. Can you kind of go elaborate on that a little bit more?
As far as what's it, I'm sorry?
You used the term rating, your military rating. You said 100%. Kind of elaborate on what you mean by that.
Okay, for each thing that you say that's wrong with you, a rater goes in and checks and gives a rating from 10 to 100%. Like, I broke my right hand in the Army, and by me not being a physical, I'm finishing my physical therapy, my hand is not right. I can't use my hand 100%. Okay, so a rater will go in and look at it and say, well, based upon the, you know, the treatment you receive, we'll give you a rating of 20% for your hand. So then they look at my lower back. I hurt my back lifting a tire. Then they say, okay, based upon the pain you have in your lower back for this many years, we'll give you a rating of 30. And then together, they'll combine those together, and I have a rating of 50%. A lot of people think that once you got 100%, that means you got 100% overall. No, they give you a rating based upon each infraction that you have, and then from there, they give you a percentage of that, and then that's what gets you to 100%. I hope I'm making sense with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to make sure that, you know, when people talk about, you know, your percentage of disability, there's a formula that goes into that. So although you may have something that's, you know, that's that you think was wrong with you, or you may incur some type of injury while you're in the military, but, you know, there's a formula that they put together that says, hey, at the end of the day, you are now have a disability of X percent. And an X percent is based on all the things that they find wrong with you. And so that goes to Chief Hurst's point about making sure you document every little niche and scratch that you go through. Chief Hurst, talk a little bit about what's that process like.
I'm actually going through that process now where we have to go through physicals and stuff like that. And they look through your medical record. Now, the VA offers is veterans that are rated that can look through your medical record for you to bring out things that you wouldn't even think you could get a rating for. And they can write that stuff down. So when you go through your physical, these are the things that you write down. So the VA do offer that. I learned that at TAP also, that they have people out there to help you with your rating. And in Texas, they have some very good people who I'm learning. I'm actually going to use some people in Texas. And, of course, I'm in Oklahoma, but I'm going to use the VA through Texas to help me with my rating.
That's awesome. Orlando, did you have to go through any kind of similar process when you got out? I know you mentioned that. Okay, so talk about your experience with getting the rating.
Well, when I got my rating, at first, when I knew nothing about it, and I actually was talking to a female, and she began to explain the process to me, and she talked me through the paperwork, actually, and I did the paperwork in 05, and I kept going to see the doctor, but, you know, they had denied me. They denied my claim, and then I put in again, and they denied my claim again. And then the third time, I went through the VA representatives. I didn't try to do it myself anymore. I went through the VA representatives, and I didn't have any part in it. I don't know what they did. I know Obama, when he came into office, you know, he was really big on, you know, trying to get some of these soldiers benefits that, you know, hadn't been receiving their benefits. So when mine went in, they sent me in to see a rater. The rater didn't agree with him, and I'm in the process of rebutting it. But he gave me a rating of 20%, 10% on each knee.
Wow. You know,
but you can definitely, that rating can continue to go up as the years progress, and your whatever disability you have, it degenerates more, you know, it continues to degenerate, and your rating can go up. But it's a process. It's tedious. You know, you have to stand in there. You have to keep going to see your doctor, you know, and sooner or later, you know, you'll receive, you know, what you deserve. But it's a process, and it's a long, tedious journey, you know, and I'm just grateful, though, that, you know, that I stuck in there, you know, because it took so many years. I didn't think that I, you know, was going to receive anything. And my knees were, and I have what they call arthritis, really, really bad in my knees, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I played ball for the military, you know. And even when I got out, I still played ball for the military through my wife, you know.
Right. Okay, yeah. So I want to shift the conversation now a little bit to to the leadership styles, right? You know, we were in the military and we got out of the military and we had this mindset of, you know, if I'm the person that's in charge, if I tell you to do something, my expectations are for you to do it. And if you don't do it, then there are consequences. Now, of course, in a military context, that's the case because there are strict policies and procedures and consequences for people not doing what they're told. But in civilian life, there's not so much. So, Orlando, let's talk to you. Let's start with you about your experience from dealing with people in the military and the rigid nature, and then dealing with civilians. What has been your experience?
Well, for me, the transition was very difficult. For the simple fact that I had got so, you know, used to routines, getting up early in the morning, you know, getting a lot done, you know, constantly every hour basically is accounted for until you get off at 6, 5, 6, 7, whatever time you got off in the evening. Whereas in the civilian world, that structure is not as concrete, and people don't take direction as well. You know,
well put. Well put.
It was like pulling teeth. You know, on every job I had difficulties. You know, because I'm so used to policies and procedures and
right.
things being cut and dry. You know, and mm-hmm. reading them and learning them and knowing them and applying them to the job. But in the civilian world, it's not like that. You know, you have loopholes. You have groups of people, you know, the good old boys, and you have all these different things that in the military you have, but you could combat through policy and procedure.
Right.
You know, when you get on the outskirts, then they can go around all those policies and procedures. So if you don't find yourself confining or finding a way to get in where you fit in, you'll find yourself losing jobs or starting over and over time and time again because of what you're used to.
Yeah.
You know, and that was my case where I finally found my niche in working with kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, boy, mm-hmm. not just rewarding, but easier to work with kids than it was to work with adults.
Right, because the expectation for kids is they don't have the structure in place, or they may not be mature enough to know what's right and wrong. But adults should know. So our expectation for them is to do what's right, and our patience is a lot thinner when it comes to dealing with adults that are supposed to be doing the right thing, and in a lot of cases are not. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. We're talking to Orlando James and Chief Hurst about our experiences in the military, and we would love for you to join the conversation. So, James, let's shift to you now. What has been your experience from making that transition?
Well, it's definitely a transition, Patrick. Just trying to get used to people who just point blankly do what they want to do. I was working in a civilian job working for Pepsi Cola. You know, you try to help guys out, give them, you know, some direction and some guidance.
Right.
They'll flat out cuss you out. You know what I'm saying? They'll be like, you ain't no better than me. You don't know nothing. You're trying to give guidance and direction, you know, but in the military, you give somebody some direction and some guidance like that, they appreciate it. They'll be like, okay,
they're welcome,
you know,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, I'm moving on and carrying on, you know, but in civilian world, you might as well go ahead and might as well start fighting.
So what's interesting about that is that, you know, for all of the listeners out there and across the, you know, all seven continents, a lot of military soldiers are going to be getting out of the military here soon. And there is a transition that one has to make when they're coming from from military service to civilian. And it's not that they, you know, are brainwashed, if you will, because that's the term I used for a long time to say I was brainwashed because of all of the military regulations I had inside me, the way I thought, the way I walked, the way I talked, I mean, everything. And so, but it is a difference. And so people have to recognize that when you're in the military and you transition to civilian life, there is a strong learning curve, if you will, that a soldier has to take to be able to cope with civilians. And it is not easy as one would think. So, Chief Hurst, what is your you know, hearing this information, how are you going to prepare to make that transition?
Well, you know, hearing this information is kind of funny because I'm just so, like you say, I'm used to, you know, telling somebody what to do, and if it don't be done, you, of course, it's consequences.
Right.
You know, you're supposed to be somewhere. Well, you could stay 2 hours late today. You know, I can make your schedule. It's going to be an adjustment and, you know, kind of nervous about it, but excited about it at the same time. And I guess I'm just going to have to get out there with the grind and figure it out.
All right. We're going to go to the phone lines right now to join the conversation. The number to call is 323-580-5712. Caller, you're on Current Events with Patrick Cook. Give us your name and where you're calling from.
This is Darren Riddick, and I'm calling from Virginia. I think my cousin's still up on the line. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you well.
Okay, that's great. That's great. My cousin James up on the line in Texas.
Okay.
What's going on, James?
All right, Dad. How you doing, bro?
Hey, baby. I'm trying to maintain. I'm in here caulking up some walls and whatnot for this rental property, but I was y'all got me kind of interested about the topic with the transition of soldiers coming off of military duty and transitioning back into a world where it's a totally different climate in terms of reestablishing yourself or trying to fit in. It's not the easiest thing because most of us go right into the military right after high school, so you don't even really get the opportunity to get an idea of what it's like to deal with on a commercial level, to even understand some of the biases and some of the cliques like one of the previous callers spoke about. And things of that nature. That's one of the things I learned about the military, and that you got to be, you know, some of the things you got to come to terms with in terms of America. The military, in many respects, might be one of the fairest employments you'll go to. It's on you whether or not you progress with your military education. It's on you whether or not you excel and get your package ready for promotion and things of that nature to some degree. You know, the fairness in terms of excelling is a little different than it is in the commercial light.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
So,
mm-hmm.
So for some folks, in terms of defining their way commercially, it can be kind of touch and go because you're going in, and we're in the military going to give you all the education you need to be thorough at your position in the military. You kind of got to find your way commercially. You might get picked up, be a bagger, and you might not never get to be in the management section. Have nothing to do with ambition and things of that nature. It could be other things. But so finding your way commercially is somewhat of a challenge for a lot of people because most people go into the military not really having a means or a way of just taking care of themselves ordinarily. And that's,
right.
It's volunteer in many respects, but it's not. It's not. It's designed.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed for those, you know, kind of in need. You know, we need something that we can do where we can come right out. And if you ain't going to college and you ain't got no money to go to college, or you ain't playing sports, or you ain't doing something that you're gifted at a particular thing, then there aren't many avenues for you to come out and be able to hold your own, so to speak. And so folks come into the military and they learn the climate and they can excel at that, or some of them don't. The discipline or what's required is too challenging for them. They come out. But it's still, in terms of going into the commercial sector, it's a whole nother realm of adjusting and learning, just like you had to find your place or still are finding your place in the military.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you for your call. We appreciate that.
I say who?
So I want to kind of elaborate on what the caller talked about. And he hit two real key points. And he said the level playing field. And this is what I kind of interpret. It's not what he said, but he basically said that the military gives you a level playing field. You can, as an individual, you know the rules of the game. They tell you, they publish them, they make them known, so here's how you progress, and you get an opportunity to kind of show what you got, basically. So, Chief Hurst, talk a little bit about your experience with the level playing field.
Well, you know what? I have to agree with him because, you know, right now the military had more programs to pushing people out than to promote people. But what that says, if you're in there, you're going to work on time, you're doing the extracurricular stuff, you're getting your education, you're doing your community service, it's a level playing field in that expense because we have people that, you know, they come to work every day where you're expected to come to work every day. Now they're looking at what else are you doing?
Right.
Are you going, you getting your education? Are you doing community service? You know, so in that aspect, yeah, it's a level playing field. You can play your own cards. If you choose just to come to work every day, you won't be promoted. If you get out there and do the extra stuff, it's easy to get promoted. So I agree with him on that aspect.
So James, let me let you respond to this. The fact that, you know, you spent over a decade in the military, you saw the level playing field, or did you see the level playing field? And I want you to compare it to your civilian experience.
Well, for me, both were similar, simply because due to my lack of knowledge, I was just a worker. You know, you have some people who are just worker bees and just go out and do what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Not trying to, you know, education or do anything better than that because, you know, you're just a worker.
Right.
I was caught up in that. I came in at 21 years old, actually at 37, but during that time, it was never a big push or a big thrust for education. You know, it was never one of those things, what are you doing to further yourself? You know, that's one thing I thought about being in the military, you know, and I hope anybody out there listening who around troops, please tell your troops to, you know, further education and better themselves. You know, that's when we're going to get ahead. Secondly, when I got into the civilian world, you know, it was a dog and pony show, a cutthroat race. You know, you got to be better than the next person. You got to do five more things better than the next person before you get your promotion.
Mm-hmm.
So you always have to find and go way beyond the call so that you can get noticed and get that promotion. Without that, you like you said, you'll just be a regular bagger. You'll never get into management because, you know, you're a great bagger. You get everything right, never crush your egg. But they're looking for more than that right now. They're looking for somebody who got enough initiative to take the eggs and wrap the eggs and put them in a separate bag. You know,
mm-hmm.
So they're looking for something to go the extra mile.
Right. Orlando, your what's been your experience?
Well, for me, I just noticed that the competition in the military was a lot more even for the simple fact that, like you said, it was rules and regulations, it's policies and procedures. I just did 2 years of service, and I have two AMs and an R-Com in just 2 years of service.
Wow.
You know, so that let me know that there was some equality and that I could fight and make my way. Why I got out to this day, I don't know. But when I got out, I noticed that it's a different competition. It's more competition to whereas, you know, in the military, there was a policies and procedure thing. You just learning more than the next person. In the civilian world, there's your boss like you, you know, what do you mean to the franchise, you know, or can you fit in, can you get in when you fit in as far as meeting the criteria of what they're looking for, you know, because there's always some hidden barriers that you don't know about, you know, especially when you've been in the military and then you come into the civilian world, you know, it's a hustle and bustle that's a little bit different from that life. And you have to make some adjustments. You have to learn to gird your tongue. You have to learn to be quiet. You know, you have to learn to even though this is policy and procedure, sometimes I have to let things go. You have to learn to pick and choose your battles. It is a completely different world, but you can make it, but it's finding that niche, like the caller said before. You know, finding it is something that you're good at, something that you can excel in, you know, which is difficult for a lot of military people because of that structure. And it continues to go on, and that's why you have so many homeless. That's why you have so many military folks that are jobless, you know, because of that structure that they're used to. And in the civilian world, it's just a totally different world.
Yeah, you know, I want to add to that the fact that it has been my experience that, you know, while I was in the military, the rules were published and, you know, things were kind of laid out for you. So everybody was shooting at the same target. But when you get out of the military and you enter the civilian sector, it is truly about skill and politics. You can never underestimate the politics that's involved in your career when you're in the civilian sector, because it is not only how good you are, but it's also how good your relationships are. And so one of the things I've been experiencing since I've been out is that, you know, initially I was saying I wanted to be the best at this, right? I don't care who I know or who is involved with the solution. If I have the right solution, it should be acceptable. You know, as an engineer, you know, we deal in ones and zeros. You can pretty much take out perception. You can pretty much take out your opinion because either it works or it doesn't work. But what I come to realize that it is more than just having the right solution. You have to be involved with the politics. You have to go out and do those, you know, I'm not going to call them senseless because there's a lot of value into having dinner with your colleagues, going to lunch with your colleagues, you know, and doing those, you know, those small little bitty things. And although, you know, a lot of your colleagues may not look like you, they may not have your same background, but that small investment creates that opportunity for you to, you know, at least be in a discussion when it comes to advancement. Because although, you know, in a lot of cases we may be qualified and we may have the right skill sets, but we're not in that conversation because we don't know the people that are making the decisions. So, you know, the takeaway here from this component is basically when you make the transition, you should also focus on the politics as well as your skill set. And there's a great book out there called Political Savvy by Joel DeLuca, Dr. Joel DeLuca. I would encourage people to go out there, especially making that transition, to see how important the politics is. And when you hear that term, sometimes there's a lot of negative connotations associated with politics. But the reality is that is the life that one lives in the civilian sector. So you have to understand, you know, the dynamics that you're faced with in order to be able to at least maneuver in that in the civilian environment. And so we're reaching the end of the show here. I want to kind of do a round robin to get, you know, to get some final thoughts from each of you. So Chief Hurst, we'll start with you.
Well, as I actually going through this transition, I see that it's more and more important that we document any injury, any sickness, anything that we have. So if I had to put out anything, I would tell anybody that's in the service now, make sure that you get anything documented that's wrong with you because it's going to benefit you later on.
Okay. James, final comments.
Yes, as for me, if anyone's in the military this time, make sure you get your rating before you get out. Definitely for those who waited, like myself, 10 years after the fact, like one of the other callers said, you're going to have to fight your battles and you're going to have to wait a long time, but it's worth the wait. But, you know, it's one of the things, if you can do it before you get out, do it then because it's a lot quicker and a lot easier.
Okay, Orlando.
Yeah, I would just like to send a shout out to all veterans to realize that there are a lot of programs out there, voc rehab programs. There's a lot of like you said before, stress management, PTSD, anger management, smoking cessations. There's a lot of things that are out there, and you just have to search for them, and you have to be tedious in your walk because a lot of times when you get out of the military, you're left desolate and empty because there's one world you're going to a completely other, you know, and you have to utilize the things that you've worked for to get what you need. And that's where I'm at now. I'm back in a transition. I'm self-employed, looking for work, you know, but I'm still got to eat and still got to pay child support or whatever else you got to do. But I would just encourage, you know, I would just encourage soldiers all over the world to continue to fight, continue to prepare for their transition, educate yourself, arm yourself. You know, because it's a whole other world out here. The civilian world is totally different from the military world. And if you're not ready, it'll eat you up or it'll drive you crazy and depress you. And if you get to that point, there are a lot of programs that help bring you out. And so don't keep your eyes closed. Keep reading. Keep searching for answers. And as long as you put your time in and you got out with that honorable discharge, there's opportunity for you that you don't know about. You just have to seek it out.
All righty.
Okay.
Well, that's our show for today. I would like to thank all our listeners for tuning in. A special thank to Orlando, James, and Chief Hurst. And of course, I would like to thank my co-host, Jima Hill Cook. I want to remind everybody that this summer, Faith Missionary Baptist Church, in conjunction with TaylorMade Training and Consulting, will host its second annual summer feeding program. There are three ways that you can help. You can send a donation to TaylorMade101.com and click donate or volunteer. And of course, tell others how our program help feed hungry children and discuss how their organization can help. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business and nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. Remember, it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Now don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. Again, thanks to Orlando, James, and Chief Hurst. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer. Take us away, Joyce.